Welcome to The Bible Preacher, your weekly podcast where we talk about the Bible and make a playlist. I'm Matt Cable, pastor at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Zach Paris. I'm the pastor of Lutheran Campus Ministry at the University of Colorado Boulder. And if there were to be a super league of ministries in the ELCA, man, I have to assume that you and I both would be super league pastors.
Yeah, that's what we should do. We'll break away from the ELCA.
Mm-hmm.
We'll stop, like St. Mark's gonna stop subsidizing all these little churches.
Yeah.
And we're gonna
beat it.
Form our own Super League.
The TV
what
rights.
Would work? The TV rights, that's right.
They're gonna be through the roof.
The TV rights. Yeah, that was definitely the top story this week. It was not, but I did thoroughly enjoy. It was like my break from the serious stories.
Yeah.
It all fell apart yesterday, and I was like, this is amazing. Like, how did this happen? Like, these are extremely powerful, wealthy people that, like, for some reason put out a press release or something on Sunday, and then the whole thing fell apart by Tuesday. How does that happen?
Yeah. Matt, I want so many things for the world. One of the things I want for the world is for, like, every day to not be so heavy that I can't come onto the podcast and spend 15 minutes before we talk about the Bible talking about ridiculous things that don't matter. But evidently, that's not how the world we live in anymore works or ever really has been. But now, yeah, whatever. But it was lovely. It was lovely to look at this thing. My favorite part, Matt, is it was financed by J.P. Morgan Chase. Right. And there one of the article I've listened to so many, quote unquote, emergency podcasts because like they were dropping them. All my soccer podcasts were dropping them like Super League has come out. Oh, no. Emergency episode. The other Premier League, 14 other Premier League clubs. They're having a meeting. Emergency, like just emergency pod after emergency pod after emergency pod. My favorite detail is that they talked about how nobody spent any money on this. Like, they all just signed up in theory. Nobody was going to pay for anything. J.P. Morgan was going to front the cash, right? And they said that J.P. Morgan has a committee that decides whether it's worth it for them to get involved in transactions that might be controversial. And this decision went through that, and they said, yeah, it won't be that bad.
What?
It blew up. It did not last as long as the Fyre Festival.
Incredible. Is it going to be controversial? Presidents of European countries were weighing in and exploring legislative action about that. Like, what?
Yeah, I loved it. You know, I mean, as good friend of the podcast, Roger Bennett likes to say, sports is the most important of the least important things. And it was a fun place for me to put my energy because... It's just remarkable as an American and somebody who grew up in the American sports system to see the repudiation of the American franchise model where there's no consequences for losing and just the outrage it sparked across. And it's so bizarre what's the word? Dichotomous? That's not the word. There's a word Vitor like to use that I can't think of. The Europeans... rejected the socialist sort of worldview of taking care of the owners in favor of a more laissez-faire, you have to earn your way. Because, dear listener, if you can catch details, a number of those, 12, quote-unquote, super clubs in European soccer announced that they're going to break away, and then it all fell apart in 2 days. But a number of those clubs are owned by Americans who... One of whom, as a sometimes Denver resident, who owns our local club, the Crapids, Stanley Kroenke, also owns your NFL franchise there, who you've made some money off of.
Okay, yeah.
He owns Arsenal, and everybody at Arsenal has always hated him, and now they would probably literally attack him if they showed up at a stadium.
Wow. Yeah, Arsenal, I saw, put out a statement apologizing to their fans.
They actually apologized, yeah.
Like... It's just amazing to me that you could misread the
read
tea leaves that badly.
The room.
I mean, I don't.
Oh,
like,
it's good preaching advice.
I don't know the, the ins and outs of European soccer that well. I might know like some of the base. I'm not super invested in this, but just reading the like the initial description is like, oh, this just seems like a shameless cash grab. This is really, this sounds really bad. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know what model is the best, but just like, this seems like a really greedy move, right? And then to see it fall apart, it's just, it seems kind of gleeful to watch that happen. I also super enjoyed, like, somebody should just make a mini series of it, because it just seems like it'd be really entertaining. Like, there were a couple German clubs, like, Bayern Munich was like, nope, like, the entire time. And they kept, like, trying to beg them publicly, like, we really think they're going to get on board.
Oh, they'll be on board.
And they got to look really good right now, because they were like...
Well, they couldn't. Whatever that they wouldn't get on board, like, because teams in Germany are required to have 50% of their ownership. They have to be owned at least 50% by fans. So the fans would have to approve it, and they're not going to approve it in Germany. Paris Saint-Germain, a little less altruistic. They are owned by the United Arab Emirates. No, they're owned by Qatar. The sovereign wealth fund of Qatar. So they're not like, they're not the ones you want to lift up as the champions of the little people here. As we prepare for Qatari World Cup 2022 in the middle of the summer. They're just, we're also involved in some of the governing body of soccer in Europe. UEFA is, you're not going to believe this, Matt, like all international sports agency, corrupt. And their ownership was involved in the corruption on the receiving corruption side. So they didn't, like, it would have been like cutting off their nose to spite their face sort of thing. So they stayed out for that reason. But
amazing.
Nuts.
Amazing.
Matt, it was hard for me to appreciate all of it. Well, number one, let's talk about how fun it is, okay, to see billionaires and sovereign wealth funds drug through the mud in public without any like real harm or violence being done to anybody and seeing the little people win for once and again the part of the world, the most important of the least important things, how enjoyable that was. My enjoyment of it was dampened though, Matt. Because I received, like you did this weekend, the second dose of the Moderna vaccine. I got my second dose of the Moderna on Sunday. I got my third dose of the Pfizer on Wednesday. And I had heard, Matt, that there were after the second dose, you get side effects, you know. And woo, boy, I am glad I did it. You should do it. It wrecked me, Matt. I felt awful for a full day. Like...
Yeah. How did it develop? Like, when did you get the shot?
I got the shot because I needed to do my part, Matt. I needed to do my part. And I just happened to find on the King Supers, which is our local grocery chain, an appointment. And you had to put both appointments at the same time. The first time I could get it was when we were on a little mini spring break that we've talked about that was terrible. But we went up in the mountains in Granby, Colorado. And so that's where my second one had to happen, too. So on Sunday, I had to go up in the morning and ski first, get one more day in, and for the people, for public health. And then after that, at lunch, I drove up to get my shot about 1:15 is when they stuck it in my arm. I got back. They're doing outdoor worship on Sunday evenings at St. Aidan's. So I went to that, which is really lovely. We had some wonderful weather. And then we did our student dinner because the weather is awful this week. It's snowing and cold right now, and it's been snowing and cold for a couple days. So we did dinner with students at 6. I got home by 7:30, 8. Sat on the couch and started to think, I don't feel great. But it was also a little bit of like, the same kind of feeling, like, I've had a couple of drinks, and, like, this is enough kind of thing. Not like I hadn't died yet. And then I woke up probably 2 a.m., freezing to death, like, shivering, chattering, like, my whole body was shaking. So then it was mostly, like, that fever and just feeling awful for the rest of the day. And then on Tuesday... I was kind of like 50% back. Like, I'd feel pretty good, but then I'd overdo it and then be like, oh, I actually don't feel great. But today we recorded on Wednesday and I feel pretty good. Pretty good. How about you, good. Matt? Good. How was your...
Yeah, no, pretty similar. Except I didn't go skiing. But I went for a run that morning and then I got my shot about 9 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday. And I was really nervous because I knew that, like, 24 hours later, you start to get the effects, maybe, if you're going to get them. And I have church 24 hours after
that. Yeah.
So I was worried. I pre-recorded my sermon. I got everything done. But still was like, you know, I still run the tech and everything. So, and yeah, it was like, you know, by the end of the day, like a little bit tired, but I was like, I don't know. And then, yeah, 1 a.m. woke up shivering, freezing.
Oh my gosh. So
just terrible. Got like enough of an adrenaline burst to like do church. And then I had like a meeting after church. And by the end of that meeting, I was just done, crashed for several hours. Just, yeah, it was pretty brutal. It was like having the flu, but only for like a day.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way you want the flu, if you're going to get
right.
it.
Right,
you just want it for a day. Because I was behind you. I didn't know it ahead of time. But after I, like, started feeling that bad, I was like, how on earth did Matt, like, lead worship?
Yeah.
In the middle of this.
I mean, it was mostly, you know, we have an assisting minister who also basically, like, leads the non-preaching parts, non-preaching and communion. Mm-hmm. And I recorded the preaching, so that was done. So I really just had to do communion. And that was it.
There you go. Wow. Wow. You know, they say that the strong response, though, just indicates that your first vaccine worked really well. Because it's stimulating the response, like the immune response, right? So it's like, oh, there's the virus. Let's beat the crap out of it. And it did. So, also, it sounds like, Matt, and I'm a little upset about this. It feels a little ageist. I don't think people have been talking about it. That people, like, specifically at our age, are, like, getting destroyed by it. Like, older people don't have a strong reaction. And younger people, like, my students are all like, yeah, I didn't feel great, but I was okay. I was fine. Like, you jerks.
I just, yeah, no, I mean, I had heard that, too, that it just means it's working. And so I just imagined a training montage. Like, I just watched this training montage on a Marvel show. And so it was like Rocky. It was like, my immune system is not facing a real opponent. It's a training montage. It's training.
Is this another episode of, let's talk about Falcon Winter Night Soldier? A.K.A. Forrest Gump 2?
That's such a good episode.
Was it?
I really enjoyed it. Yes,
I hadn't seen Forrest Gump in a while.
They work on the boat together.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
bonding.
The Winter Soldier is Lieutenant Dan, clearly.
Yeah, right. Sure.
You're right. Like, they're huge Lieutenant Dan vibes from like the amputee working on the boat, right?
Oh, it's amazing! It's amazing. And surprise guest, Julie Louis-Dreyfus.
That was a good part. That was a good part.
She's so good. Really brought the Veep vibes. Like, it's great. Oh. Mm. Well, that's all that happened this week. Nothing.
That's all we need to talk about. Nothing else.
Nothing else, really. Well, we're recording this on Wednesday. Yesterday, as we're recording this, the verdict came down in the Derek Chauvin trial. We don't lead with that because we know that you come to this podcast to check out of these important things a little bit. We hope that you find other outlets.
That's why we come to the podcast.
To wrestle with these things. I mean, I'll say, so my own reaction here, like, I'm at a church that is a part of a coalition that was formed in the wake of the Rodney King verdict. So verdicts are a big deal around here. And I just did not, like, yeah, seemed like pretty overwhelming evidence. You got pretty good video evidence, 40 witnesses, all the things. And yet still, I thought it's going to be like... You just don't know, right? Like,
yeah.
All the evidence in this particular case, but all the evidence in American history points toward not going the way you want it to. So to hear that guilty verdict three times. I felt, as a preacher, I felt relief not only that, like, I mean, that for once I could go into the pulpit and it wouldn't just be overwhelming grief. How do I preach on overwhelming grief and anger? Like, to be able to preach at least a little bit on a glimmer of good news, which is a shift. It's actually a change. And that's that's the part of it that is really depressing, right? That, like, this shouldn't really be that exciting.
Yeah. I'd actually have to preach this week, Matt, in real time. Actually, like, for the text we're going to talk about and for the text we talked about last week, which, you know, there's a time warp element to the podcast. That's a Sunday that's still coming up for us. And yeah, you know, all the things, like, I don't, you know, we talked about reading The Room and reading the social media room this week. I did not feel like I had anything of value to really add to that particular room, you know, about the verdict or anything. You know, I posted something today, but that's, you know, one skill or expertise I might have is knowing about the Bible. So I've got that. So there you go. I think the difficult thing for the preacher this week, for me as a preacher, will be, and me as a preacher preaching in exclusively white context on Sunday, is to preach it so that it is a glimmer of hope, of good news, and to find that balance of making sure there's good news, number one, because you could still preach it pretty, it's much easier to preach the bad news of the situation, because it's right there, and because you probably, like, well-intentionedly, I don't want to make it like everything's great now. But I do think it still needs to be good news. But I think it's actually pretty difficult work this week of being honest about the bad news of the situation, but also finding that, not even balance, right, but like the appropriate, to have that note of good news, which is what I think it needs to be, a note of good news that rings out, but have that still be pretty clear note within all the other stuff that you really need to pay attention to. And tend to.
Well, and yeah, yes to all of that. And the thing that I'd like to figure out to explore is like it feels like true justice would be the resurrection of George Floyd and the redemption of Derek Chauvin. Like that, and that is probably the justice that lies, you know, at the end of the book of Revelation. Like this is the end game. So what this is accountability. Like it's this accountability along the way. And so how is accountability good news? I mean, it's not how we usually think about good news. And I feel like there's such a temptation to be like that this is justice and that like, but it's, I mean, clearly, I don't know. How is accountability is like not really that ambitious a thing, but it is part of it. It does need to be part of like faithful living together as humans on the planet, right?
So maybe that's how you do it. Matt, I like that. That's going to help me a lot.
which for real? Is what?
Yeah. You're not going to believe this, Matt. Breaking. We've got an emergency episode of the podcast. This podcast helped me preach this week. Maybe that's I think that's being really clear about what the good news is and what like justice is and what it looks like. That, you know, the good news is that there will be resurrection for George Floyd. There will be redemption for Derek Chauvin. Because I haven't heard a lot of that. I haven't heard that at all. You know, this is the first time I've heard that. Not to say that we're here or there or it's going to be easy at all to get there, right? But to have the kind of telos of it, that like this is how far, like that's the good news, that's justice, it will happen. But also look around us and see how far we have to go before those things happen, so that the glimmer is a glimmer of this bigger. I'm struck by I always like the image of old Crow Medicine shows. I Hear Them All. And it has a line, right? The flower growing up in the rubble of the towers. I think that's just a really persuasive image of where I think it's where we're at, right? That this is just a dandelion growing up in the cracks of of the tower that's starting to break, but is so far from being broken, right, from this foresty sort of thing, and that maybe that helps it to be good news, right, when you can connect this small thing, small yet necessary accountability piece as a necessary step to get to, and then having some clarity around the far-off vision and what that looks like.
Yeah. And, like, to make it really particular, like, to drill down on that accountability piece, like, I feel like it's not even... like, part of it is the distance between here and there. But the thing that also feels powerful about the accountability is that, like, for Black folks, like, there's like, that accountability is so rare. Like, so just having that moment of accountability is also this, like, statement about, it's like a statement of equity. It's a statement of, like, I mean, to use the language of Black Lives Matter, right? Like, why would one moment of accountability be that powerful? It doesn't actually move you that far down the road if we're thinking about, like, this linear sense of time. Time is a construct, I've heard it said on this podcast. But, like, just that what is that moment of accountability? Like, what is the theological role of accountability? You know? I'm curious about that. Like, let's say the tower falls tomorrow. We have no idea. Like, we have no idea what the actual, like, time distance is. What is the theological value of accountability? If only we knew what it was in Greek, then we would.
Able. Taking account. Yeah. To take account. I mean, maybe that's the... could be good news, you know. In this, I mean, you're going to have some nuanced good news this week, friends.
I mean, especially if you're preaching, like, in a white context, like, it's so hard. I feel like we have such a hard time with accountability. Like, we treat, like, any kind of judgment so often as, like, you know, you're talking about vocation. Like, is this judgment on my entire being? And what if it's just accountability? Like, what? How do we as white, as people living under whiteness, like, get comfortable with accountability, and how is that, like? But then, like, theologically, like, what's the role of that? And I wonder if it helps to break. If one of the things that binds us is this this edifice of whiteness that's been constructed to benefit us, but also distorts us and makes us into what Derek Chauvin became, to, like, that this is also like a accountability is what helps to break that down, right? I don't know. We're thinking out loud on the podcast, which is always a great idea. that's what I would push. I just would say, yeah, what's the theological value of accountability, and how can accountability be good news?
Maybe that's important to say too. You know, as we're thinking out loud, just for preachers to hear that you're not going to figure this out in one sermon this week. It's going to be hard to preach this week, and steel yourself to not solve everything in your sermon.
Yeah, absolutely. Do not try to solve everything. Yeah, and it is all contextual, right? So, like, there are going to be those congregations that need to hear the triumphalism tempered. Again, like, I don't know, you're a community listener. So, like, you need to hear what that is. In other communities, like, you're going to need that moment of release. So, You gotta know your community too, of course, as always.
I would, at this point, Matt, like to add that if your preacher doesn't say, Nick will insert whatever the ideas I come up with later here, then you need to find a new church. No, preach to your context. Preach to your context. I am struck, Matt, thinking about things that don't matter, about how we came around to accountability in a really meaningful way. and the role of accountability in the Super League disaster. These folks who did not think they would be held accountable in public. Again, in the arena where it's the least important of the most important of the least important things. So if you've got a super specific context, you could preach on Super League and this, but I don't recommend you do that.
Don't recommend it. Man. Well, if you're preaching, I mean, you would have preached on Good Shepherd, but let's say you missed that week and now you're going to preach on May 2nd. Because we're talking about text for May 2nd. We're all out of time. Like, time is just not, it's not linear, Zach, on this podcast.
Out of time. Hey, man, did you hear that song on the radio?
Yo, turn to that station. Do we dive into Acts?
Let's dive into Acts.
All right. Finally, we get some Acts. Some, like, actual actions.
Actions.
Things happening. And not just talking about the things that just happened.
We, in our renaming the books of the Bible, should we rename it Verbs?
Just, yeah, Verbs.
Verbs. Yep. The Verbs of the Apostles.
Such a good text.
This is killer. We lead with the best, we open with the best song. We're just going to disappoint the rest of the service on Sunday.
This text was preached by a pastor of St. Mark's back in the 1940s for a sermon about racial inclusion and what it would mean to become a church, quote unquote, church for all races, which might sound, maybe that's a corny way to put it today, but at that time, as a bold move. We were very late to the game, but 3 years ago when this came up, preached about LGBTQ inclusion on our journey to be a reconciling in Christ congregation. So it is a text that can be used to talk about inclusion in so many different ways. And can be used to talk about many other things, which I'm sure that we will dive into. It begins like this. An angel of the Lord said to Philip, "Get up and go toward the south to the road that goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza." In parentheses, this is a wilderness road. So he got up and went. Now there was an Ethiopian eunuch, a court official of the Candace, I heard it's pronounced, Candace, queen of the Ethiopians, in charge of her entire treasury. He had come to Jerusalem to worship and was returning home. Seated in his chariot, he was reading the prophet Isaiah. Then the Spirit said to Philip, "Go over to this chariot and join it." So Philip ran up to it and heard him reading the prophet Isaiah. And he asked, "Do you understand what you're reading?" And he replied, "How can I, unless someone guides me?" And he invited Philip to get in and sit beside him. Now the passage of the scripture that he was reading was this: "Like a lamb he was led to the slaughter, and like a lamb silent before its shearer, so he does not open his mouth. In his humiliation, justice was denied him. Who can describe his generation? For his life is taken away from the earth." And the eunuch asked Philip, "About whom, may I ask you, does the prophet say this? About himself, or is it about someone else?" And then Philip began to speak, and starting with this scripture, he proclaimed to him the good news about Jesus. And as they were going along the road, they came to some water. And the eunuch said, "Look, here is water. What is to prevent me from being baptized?" And he commanded the chariot to stop, and both of them, Philip and the eunuch, went down into the water, and Philip baptized him. When they came up out of the water, the Spirit of the Lord snatched Philip away, and the eunuch saw him no more, and went on his way rejoicing. But Philip found himself at Azotus, and as he was passing through the region, he proclaimed the good news to all the towns until he came to Caesarea. Word of God, word of life.
Thanks be to God. What a good one. Matt, are you serious about Candace?
I feel like didn't we talk about that last time? I have it written in my notes here.
Oh, really?
So I feel like you probably enlightened us with that. Someone should go back and listen.
Yeah. One of the listeners should figure out how right I used to be. You know, this story is a lot like us at Coachella, you know. We're sitting there reading the book of Isaiah. We're reading a commentary on the Gospel of John. I like it's so fun. It's such a good story, Matt. It's such a good story. The whole first section, you can play with it, that the eunuch is reading just by himself, chilling, reading the prophet Isaiah that he doesn't understand. And immediately, you know, he asked, do you understand what you're reading? He's like, how can I unless someone guides me? It's such a fanciful, really fun story. And then people disappear. It's so good. And then the line that really makes it and makes it the perfect, such a powerful text, right, is, look, here's water. What is to prevent me from being baptized? What is to stop this new thing that God is doing?
It reminds me so much of the, like, Emmaus story, which we also love because it's such a great story, but it takes place on a road, and there's, like, this sacramental thing that happens, and then poof, person disappears. I mean, it's, like, some interesting parallels.
That's probably how you felt on Sunday, Matt, when you were doing communion. So you could do this sacramental thing. If I could just poof out of here, I can only assume Philip was carried away to bed.
That's it. Oh, and then, but even, oh my gosh, yeah. An angel of the Lord says to Philip, get up and go. It's a wilderness
stand,
road.
If you will.
I mean, you could take that. You could do stuff. Oh, my goodness. This Ethiopian eunuch, a court official of the Candace, so in charge of her entire treasury. So he's an important person. They're an important person. I mean, this is like gender non-binary here.
So
going on.
So Matt, I use this story in my in our Why Christianity thing we did a couple weeks on the Bible, and I use this as one of the stories because we had to do some deconstruction, and I used it to do some deconstruction. I don't know if it was D or E, who knows anymore. And I was telling you about this, that I found on YouTube lots of really good, like, animated videos for, like, Sunday schools about stories.
Oh, no.
And I wanted to do this one. And lots of them were from traditions that I wouldn't usually use their resources. But they were they're surprisingly good, you know? And so I was like, what do they do with a eunuch? you know, dear listener, I didn't always know what a eunuch was. A eunuch is typically a male who has been castrated, unable to father children, and oftentimes they're able to be elevated to these places of power because they're not threats to hereditary power structures. Who cares if a eunuch is? Why would a eunuch bother becoming king? Because the eunuch's never going to have children to pass it down to. That might be harder for us to understand when we have less, like, we don't care so much about legacy, like hereditary legacies and stuff. So that makes sense, right? It's an important detail of the story that this eunuch is a very powerful person. And that's the eunuch detail is important because that illustrates how important they are, what they've done, like the sacrifices they've made on behalf of the Queen of Ethiopia. So is thus rewarded. So I was like, what are they going to do with human castration? This is going to be interesting. And they didn't mention it, right? They call him an Ethiopian prince or something. And they didn't talk about it at all. And that's the thing, you know, we've got a lot of folks in recent years coming through the ministry who are non-binary. And I think it has the potential to be such good news for those folks. To hear this story that clearly has this, like, non-binary gender option that's an essential part of the story that nobody bats an eye at. It's not, like, remarked upon at all. Like, nobody cares that this person, like, it's inconsequential to, like, not inconsequential, right? But, like, nobody's like, and what makes us a great story is they were a eunuch and God does not love eunuchs. They're just like, they happen to be a eunuch, and then this stuff happened to them, and that's crazy, huh? And nobody was like, and we were of a bound conscience over whether it was okay for Philip to talk to an Ethiopian eunuch. Nobody bats an eye at this non-binary gender option. So a story where the Bible represents multiple, non-binary gender options, and it's not what the story is focused on is, I think, can be really good news.
Yeah, the story does not spend a lot of time dwelling on that, except for naming it. Like, just name, like, this is a fact. There is scholarship that suggests that, like, he came to Jerusalem to worship, but eunuchs were not allowed to worship. in the same way. And so that with that phrase, he's come to Jerusalem to worship and was returning home, that he was actually turned away at the synagogue. So there are some scholars that have argued that. And so he's trying to understand this prophet on his own. That's why he's got to read it on his own. But for sure, interesting. Oh, interesting stuff going on here. And then I also love, like, you described this whole conversation that happens between the two of them. And I mean, it could be that he's like, it's a pit stop, maybe. But just the fact that Philip is running to get up to it. And then he invites Philip to get it. Like, you almost imagine, like, Philip running alongside, right? Like, Philip's got to be in shape to do that. He's a runner, you know? Like, he's running alongside. Like, do you understand what you're... I mean, maybe he's got a good pace going. I don't know that he's able to, like, have this conversation. But it's almost comical, this idea that he's, like, running alongside this chariot that is moving along. And then the invitation that happens is not like Philip inviting him in to Philip's chariot, but like Philip gets invited into his chariot. You know, I think that's powerful. Philip gets invited into his chariot, and then together they have this conversation. Yeah, so much good stuff here. And then just when you think the story can't get any better, there's water. The baptism.
Mm-hmm. You can do your mystagogy this week.
And the eunuch just says, "What is to prevent me from being baptized?" It's just a great question. That's such a great question. It's great. Lots going on. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that the Acts is giving us like a softball, you know, big fat pitch to hit this week, because John does not. It's John, Matt, you know, again, we're in the year of Mark. And I think Mark lacks any post-resurrection stories about Jesus. So there's not a lot to talk about for these 50 days out of Mark, so we got to do some filler from John. And we've already exhausted all the stuff that happens in John after the resurrection of Jesus, or going pre-death. So life and ministry of Jesus in John. We did it last week.
I mean, I wonder what that's about. Like, why couldn't we? Like, I can envision a world where every year we got Thomas and we got Emmaus and we got a breakfast on the beach, and we just knew these stories so well because we get them every. There are plenty of Sundays where we get the same text every year. Like, it wouldn't be that big of a deal, especially when there's just good stories. But instead, we get, you know, like Easter always seems to do this. Like, the first two Sundays are maybe some stories, and then we gradually move into this more and more abstract teaching. I guess this is Easter-y? I don't know. Are you going to tell us how it's Easter-y?
Sure. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly, you know, as a pro-narrative person, I prefer stories during the season of Easter, especially compared to, you know, I don't love the John extended, in-depth, convoluted metaphors. They're not easily accessible. If I have to make a case for John 15 as an Easter season text, it's partially that there is some sacramental stuff here. We're talking about vines. It's not direct. It's a little implicit that we're talking about grapes that would be turned into wine, which the season of Easter is a good time to do reflection onto sacramental things like you're able to do with the Acts this week with baptism. So there's that. You could make the case the abide stuff is good, right? It's a great theological idea that John hammers and hammers and hammers to the point of like not being able to recognize it anymore. Let me read real quick. Jesus said to his disciples, "I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine grower or vine dresser," which is my preferred word because I get to think of images of God dressing up vines in doll's clothes, because I live in a house where we put doll's clothes on lots of different things right now, and I can only imagine that's what God was up to. Vine dresser. "He removes every branch in me that bears no fruit, and every branch that bears fruit he prunes to make it bear more fruit. You've already been cleansed by the word that I have spoken to you. Abide." Cleanse there is the same word as pruned. You've already been pruned by the word that I have spoken to you, because the prune is really cleansed. Abide in me as I abide in you. Just as the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. Those who abide in me and I in them bear much fruit, because apart from them you can do nothing. Apart from me, you can do nothing. Whoever does not abide in me is thrown away like a branch and withers. Such branches are gathered, thrown into the fire, and burned. If you abide in me, and my words abide in you, ask for whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. My Father is glorified by this, that you bear much fruit and become my disciples. The Gospel of the Lord, classic word salad, John word salad here. The last point I'll make on making a case for John 15 in Easter is that, I mean, this is central to like the theology of our campus ministry and our belonging stuff, right? Where the goal of our gatherings is to recognize the belongedness that we inherently have because we all belong to Jesus. And that's what John's proclaiming here, is this idea that what connects the Christian community, this Christian movement, the disciples at this point, is their relationship with Jesus, not primarily their relationships with one another. Reckoning with how does the Christian community continue moving forward post death and resurrection of Jesus, when Jesus is not physically there to hold the community together, is a good, might be a helpful place of reflection.
Yeah. No, that's definitely a part of it, right? That there is this shift that takes place halfway through the Easter season, where Jesus does seem to be preparing them for his departure, which is probably where this text comes from, in the midst of John, right? That he's like,
just the irony of this text, right? There's, again, there's so much here. John readings, you only need four verses, I think. You should preach on four verses, not eight. You get these two lines. He removes every branch in me that bears no fruit. Every branch that bears fruit, he prunes to make it bear more fruit. There's, either way, branches are getting cut, right? Like, he's going to either lop it all off, or he's going to cut down that branch. So like, there's this, like, you hear it, and it sounds like you're either this or you're either that. But it's actually super nuanced, right? Like, I'm going to be cutting you all no matter what. And the dead branches I'm going to cut off, and the good branches I'm just going to trim back so that they grow back more fully. That's not a big difference, right? As someone who's done both of these things unsuccessfully, easy to mess up. But the irony in it, right, like, is it sounds like the branches and the branches are all getting cut off, but in reality we're reading this text in a story where it seems like Jesus has been cut out of the situation, where Jesus isn't here anymore, and so that, you know, lots of tensions. I'm not sure what to do with that, but that's a thing that strikes me.
Yeah. Abide, branch, bear, fruit, vine. Just the same words over and over.
Just over and over again. Prunes. You, true vine. Yeah. The abide stuff's good, you know? Jesus abides in us even as, I mean, and that's, so if I'm going to flip it around to some good news here, Matt, I'm not, obviously, you can hear, super compelled by this gospel. It's not as much fun as the Acts, but, you know, the good news is the abiding of Jesus that is able to span Jesus being cut out of the situation, right? And if Jesus might abide in us and we abide in Jesus post-resurrection, might Jesus be able to abide in us even beyond when we need to be pruned back, right? Or the dead branches of our lives are cut off. You know, maybe that's the good news. You know, to wrap it around to accountability stuff. You know, there's something super cruciform about this story, and the good news that Jesus will continue to abide in us even as we cut away the parts of us that aren't working.
Yeah, you can for sure use this to think about accountability, and I think it gives us a different image than like this image of like eternal progress, and it's a different image than even of like the road. It's a different image from like, you know, the Exodus story of we're going to travel from one place to another. This image of gardening and pruning, you know, that things are going to grow and then they're going to be cut back and then we have to grow again. And it's just like this, that's a very different image of what it means to tend a community.
That is such a hard way for us to think, you know, it's the thing that I really appreciate about being in campus ministry is that it helps me to live in a more like seasonal, circular kind of like rhythm and pattern, that there is a rhythm and pattern to life, that, that things are definitely not a straight line. I'm going to be in the same place 12 months from now. I mean, again, we're looping back around to some of the early sermon talk, right? The different understandings of time, that it's not always, we got to get from here to way over there, but it's already here. Yeah, probably not the time to preach a sermon about constructs of time, but
it's always time to preach about constructs of time.
It always is, and it always isn't. That's the thing.
What do you listen to in the fullness of time?
In the fullness of time, Matt, you know, there are not a lot of songs about vines or vine branches that aren't like Hillsong songs. But Jesus is talking about fruits, and I'm going to go with Lucinda Williams' classic, Fruits of My Labor. I'm also going to put New Soul, which is the jammiest jam that I didn't know that I knew. Right, like a song I definitely knew. I'm a new soul, I came to this strange world, hoping I could learn a bit about how to give and take. But since I came here, felt the joy and the fear, finding myself making every possible mistake. New Soul by Yael Naim, because that's what's going on this Acts text. It's all about something new happening, and this is the jam, a jammy jam for you to slather all over your sermon this week. And finally, Matt, I didn't know. I struggled with what my third song was going to be this week. And when I heard you read the Acts, I knew what it was going to be. An angel of the Lord came to Philip and said, "Stand in the place where you are. Now face south." I'm putting R.E.M. Stand, which, you know, is not necessarily my favorite R.E.M. song, but it's a classic. Not off of Out of Time, which is a bummer, but off of Green, their first Warner Brothers album. Ironically, there's not a verse where Now Face South is not one of the lyrics.
Don't think about direction.
How about you, Matt? What are you listening to?
Well, just trying to think about songs that fit the moment, and I went with Kendrick Lamar's DNA because DNA seems to fit the biology that is happening in both of these texts. So Kendrick Lamar, DNA, one of my favorite songs off of the Damn album. It's just, it's fire. It's so good. It's so good. Also has me thinking about Coachella, which we just missed last weekend. We should have been there.
Should have.
Been.
Terrible Coachella news.
Today is also the anniversary of Prince's death, so there's been KCRW playing a lot of Prince songs this morning. And one of his last singles was called Baltimore, and it was about the injustices in Baltimore several years ago, back in 2015, he put that out. And then, did you know, as I was going through social justice songs, that Third Eye Blind of late 90s fame, actually has a song called Cop Versus Phone Girl that is like almost like a storytelling folk song, but you know, with a Third Eye Blind like vibe to it, that like tells a story about a cop and a girl with a phone. Like it blows my mind that this exists.
I can't Third wait Eye to Blind. Listen. I saw you on Spotify, on my Spotify social listening. So I'm very intrigued.
I can't believe it exists. Yeah. I'm just like, wow. That's what I got.
Love it, man. Any week where we put Third Eye Blind on the playlist is a special
Wish you would step back from that ledge, my friend.
And I would understand. Hey, you know, Matt, if a European Super League financed by sovereign wealth funds, some of the richest people in the world, and JP Morgan Chase can fall apart, can rise and fall in 2 days, marching around the walls, Matt, who knows with a little accountability how quickly things can change.
It's amazing. Amazing.